for Research on Disparities in Global Mental Health and a director of the Office of Rural Mental Health Research at the National Institute of Mental Health, or the NIMH. And she oversees NIMH's research efforts to increase mental health equity both locally and globally. And if any of you saw that phenomenal 2011 Lancet series on mental health, Pamela was one of the editors. And Chris Underhill is the founder president of an organization called Basic Needs, based in the UK, but it operates internationally. Basic Needs works with people living with a mental illness to provide treatment, support, employment opportunities, and many, many more things, which we'll hear about in the course of the next hour. And Chris is a social entrepreneur. He's won many awards for social entrepreneurship, including awards from the Skoll Foundation, the Schwab Foundation, and in the year 2000, the Queen had honored him with an MBE, a member of the British Empire. So do I need to refer to you as Sir Chris?
No, don't worry.
Thank goodness for that. Yeah, thanks. So I'm really intrigued by your journey, Chris, because you're a social entrepreneur. So what led you to work in the field of global mental health?
Well, I was traveling a lot in Africa and Asia, specifically India and Nepal. And I kept coming across people who were ill, very ill, with mental health problems. And I just asked the obvious question, really, which is, well, what happens to such people? And I began to realize, this was in sort of 1999, 2000, around there, I began to realize that in many cases, not a lot happened. And so they were often in great difficulty and, you know, suffering a lot. I'd worked with physically disabled people for many years, and I knew about the difficulties, the stigma and so on that physically disabled people had, but I hadn't realized how demanding and how frightening being mentally ill is or can be. And so it was a real shock when I began to understand what the kind of volumes were which were involved. For example, I hadn't realized, which I now do, of course, that there were something like 450 million people globally with mental illness at any one time. It was true then, and now with the data that's collected being rather more effective, we believe actually the number is larger. And what I also hadn't realized was that 85% of that global number were people in the developing world. So I said, why? Why would the developing world have so many more mentally ill people than the global north? And then I began to understand the relationship between mental illness, depression, anxiety disorder, schizophrenia, and so on, the relationship between mental illness and total population. And so, of course, the global south has very large populations, whether you're talking about India, 1.2 billion, China, 1.4 billion, Pakistan, you know, very, very high numbers again. And so, in aggregate, you have this enormous problem, which is that there are a very large number of people who are not being treated and who are seeking treatment but are not being given the proper attention by their governments. I'm shocked to be able to tell you that something like, for most developing countries, they spend about 0.5% of health budget on their mentally ill, and yet the people living in that country, probably who have mental illness, probably represent something like 25% in terms of years that have been disabled. So it's an extraordinary disparity. And I think just to finish the point, what I really, really was amazed by was the treatment gap. In some countries, the treatment gap is as high as 98%. In many countries in the global south, and in particularly, for example, sub-Saharan Africa, you're talking about a treatment gap of upwards of 80%. That means that there are huge numbers of people who are not basically achieving their human right to be treated fairly, to be treated medically, and to be assisted back into a rehabilitation process. So that's where I started Basic Needs.
Wow, so you've mentioned some really shocking statistics, and then you've even said some of those are likely underestimates. As a researcher, Pamela, do you agree with those, and how do those kinds of numbers inform your research?
Yes, I think Chris has good sources, so I do agree with those. I think the point to underscore is what you ended with, Chris, is the fact that those numbers represent millions of people who do not have access to care, who are not getting the kinds of care that they need. And how we actually improve access to care, those are research questions. Even in the United States, when you look at people with a diagnosis of depression, only between 2/3 and 70% actually get access to an evidence-based care. And if you go further and look at subgroups of populations in the U.S., let's say you look at people of racial and ethnic minority groups, you even see less access. And again, if you look by socioeconomic status in the United States, again, less access to treatment for depression in the last year, let's say. And so there are some great examples of the ways in which research has helped to figure out ways to increase engagement with different populations and to get people into care. So one study that comes to mind is some work that Ken Wells and his colleagues in Los Angeles have done, where Ken Wells is a researcher, and he's worked very closely with Loretta Jones, who is a community organizer. And they've spent a lot of time working in South Los Angeles and the Hollywood metropolitan area, in a largely African-American community, to educate this community about depression. What is depression? But more importantly, to find out what are the other problems people are having and where do they go for services? Because people with depression in these communities are not necessarily, they're not going to a psychiatrist necessarily. So they did a lovely study to say, where do people go to get their social service needs met, their healthcare needs? And they said, well, let's take the mental health services to those places. And they showed that by engaging, by using a collaborative model of care, they could actually go to the parks, to the housing offices, to the barber shops and beauty salons, and engage many of these places in care, and in the ability to actually identify needs for depression care and join a larger collaborative team to provide treatment. And when they actually tested this in a rigorous randomized clinical trial, they showed that this method of community engagement and this collaborative care led to fewer hospitalizations, led to better quality of life. So these are really exciting kinds of interventions that can get at some of these needs.
And that's an example of an intervention that's innovative. And in an earlier conversation we had, you mentioned that a good way of thinking about this is by thinking about interventions and innovation on the community and policy level and on the individual level. So there's different levels to it. And Chris, you're really involved with managing care of big, large numbers of people. So tell us more about innovation in that domain.
So what we did was, when we started the organization, we developed a model which was really and truly stolen from community development practice. So so if you prefer, community organizing. And so what I was faced with was I wanted to be able to include from the beginning the state. You can't really work with a very large disease type such as this without the state being involved. These are long-term illnesses, and they're going to, you know, go on for many, many years. So that was the thing. I wanted volume. So I wanted there for there to be a lot of people benefiting. And I wanted, of course, to find ways around the problem that I was also faced with, which was very, very scarce medical resources. So, for example, in Laos, I found that there were 2 psychiatrists for the whole country. In Ghana, at the time when I started the organization, we had 15 psychiatrists, 800 nurses, and 8,000 traditional healers. So go figure. We had, and we still do today, have these very great problems in terms of what you might call the medical aspect of this work. So for me, it was really important to engage the community, and I started that by a methodology of working with very low down in the sense of grassroots community members. So we attracted attention from the traditional authorities, from the local authorities. We said, can we come and work here? Can we make partnerships with the local organizations, typically in some cases mosques, churches, women's organizations, and so on? And we started to really talk about and get an idea about what mental illness is and is not. As a result of that, we began to see how a model would develop out of this, and the model essentially brings people together. It essentially ensures that their human rights are indeed prosecuted by being able to receive treatment, by the way, from the state, not from our organization. Because I figured that if we offered the treatment, we would never get out of it. You know, we would always be stuck in that dependency mode of being the people who did the treatment. But of course, it's difficult, and so we had to make sure that nurses got trained, that psychiatrists got optimized in terms of their time and so on.
Since you mentioned Ghana, can I just ask you about your social franchising model? Because that's really interesting.
Yeah, well, much later on, and this is sort of now coming full right up to date, what I've realized that with the best will in the world, funding for this kind of work is difficult. This is an area which is tremendously underfunded by the state, but it's also tremendously underfunded by philanthropy. It's a real gap in the philanthropy market, and so those people who have recognized this financially, you know, I'm eternally grateful to, but I would like a heap more to recognize this. So what I figured was that it was really important to be able to actually work locally in Ghana and to be able to draw the resources out of the Ghanaian state as much as possible. So what we now do is we draw resources out of the Ghanaian state. They provide nurses and all the rest of it. We said that. But when it comes to the social franchise, we are also able to engage large organizations. These are not small outfits, but quite large organizations created and founded by Ghanaian citizens who have sort of started to think, well, goodness, this is a big problem after all. And so can we take your model, they say to us, can we take your model and can we work with it? And we have started a process whereby we train them. We have a computer portal where we can reach them. Because the great thing with franchising is you've got to make sure that your quality remains up. As soon as you give your model to somebody else, you have to know that the quality of the model is being maintained. And that, of course, is one of the great challenges which we are now working through and developing further.
Great. And Pamela, what about interventions on the individual level?
Yeah, so individuals live in communities, and the key to actually getting care, I think some of the innovations are around the way that we deliver it. So I gave one example in Los Angeles, but what we're seeing and what some of the things that we're investing in low and middle income countries have to do with using non-traditional providers. So when you have a country, as Chris talked about, where there are two psychiatrists for the entire country, who's the person that's going to deliver these services? And I'm talking about evidence-based interventions, the things that we know work and are effective in reducing symptoms of depression, anxiety, et cetera. And so what's really exciting is that there's an increasing amount of data showing that you can train community health workers, you can train people with a high school level of education, provided that they have good supervision, ongoing quality assurance through that supervision. We're also doing some work now with peers. So the example of maternal depression, postpartum depression. We're supporting work in Pakistan and India that is actually getting moms trained to be the people that are actually delivering the intervention to other moms. And a lot of these women say, you know, when I went through this experience, there was no one to recognize this illness, there was no one to talk about, and they feel really great being able to make this kind of a contribution. So I think this is actually it's a low-tech but incredibly important intervention, and knowing that we can actually vary the kind of providers that are used to develop, to deliver evidence-based interventions. And this is useful in a lot of low-resource contexts.
You know, the evidence for using community health workers or training lay people to deal with mental health, where does that evidence come from? Is it from the U.S. or is it other parts of the world?
So actually, I think this is one area where most of this innovation is happening in the field of mental health specifically. It's happening more in other parts of the world. So we've got some, again, rigorous trials from Chile, from Pakistan, from India, from Uganda, and others that are in process in Ethiopia, South Africa, Nigeria, Ghana, showing and trying to establish how do we do this? How do we, in settings where you don't have the specialists that you need, how do you use the resources that are available in a way that provides good quality care? Because that's important, obviously, to make sure that what people are getting is quality care.
So you use the word low-tech And we're talking about interventions, but actually very little of what you mentioned is pharmaceutical. But you mentioned the philanthropy gap, Chris, and I want to ask you about perhaps the drug company gap, because it has been reported on, I've seen reports on The Guardian and Forbes, that actually more drug companies are leaving the field of mental health, especially depression and schizophrenia, than there are entering it. Why would that be, given the scale of the problem?
I think that right now pharmaceutical companies see neuroscience as a high-risk area. There was a talk earlier this morning where we were told that the way that pharmaceutical companies typically work is that you identify a target, a molecular target, you develop a medication that targets that, and that's hopefully what will treat the illness. And we need more of that data in neuroscience to really better understand the mechanisms underlying these disorders. So one reason is that we don't have all of those data. We don't fully understand the mechanisms that we need to understand. And what you want to do if you're going to develop something is develop something that's significantly better than what's currently existing. And to do that means looking for new mechanisms. Now, there are some, everyone hasn't pulled out of this. There are some companies that are doing some exciting things. There's a new intranasal ketamine, which is an anesthetic, for people that don't know, that Johnson & Johnson has developed, which is an incredibly remarkable treatment for treatment-resistant severe depression. And so there are possibilities. But I think equally important, though, is that as we begin to conceptualize the mechanisms underlying these disorders as problems of circuits, of brain circuits, there may be other kinds of interventions. So it may be that instead of taking a pill, a more appropriate intervention for certain kinds of cognitive disorders may be retraining that circuit. And you might do that with a video game, or you might do that with another kind of device. So the market is certainly hopping in the device field, even if it's not in the traditional pharmaceutical field. But I also just want to come back to one other. So, you know, as we understand these kind of circuit-based mechanisms, psychotherapy again comes into play as an important intervention, because that's the way it works. It actually retrains circuits, and it becomes another low tech along with all of these other high tech interventions that are in development.
What's your take on that, Chris?
Well, just to go back to the drugs. So basically, most of the drugs that we use, in fact, I think all of them really, are generic drugs. So they've been around for quite a while. And they've come off license, and those are the drugs that are used in most developing countries, and in fact elsewhere as well. And so, I suppose the point really is that there isn't another generation in the sense that Pamela's been talking about, or generation after the current generation, which is that much better. And so, from that point of view, it's important. In Vietnam, over a 2-year period in the city of Hue, We had 1,000 people with anxiety disorder go through the program, a program of 8,000 in all. We offered people in that 1,000, we offered them the choice of a talking therapy or a pharmacological therapy. And interestingly, it split down half and half. And so, and whilst that's managerially interesting, it's not a study that we've proven to your standards, Pamela, but nevertheless, managerially, it is an important feature. And I think when people get the knowledge, when they understand the issues, then they can make choices. And so the people that actually work with them in the talking therapy side were actually, interestingly enough, either community health workers or community health doctors in the Vietnamese context. These were people who were in charge of a district health facility. And they learned, first of all, how to apply the seven-step talking therapy, and then it went from there. It was an exciting time, administered in the sense of organized by the provincial authorities, the health authorities on the one hand, and by the Provincial Women's Association on the other, and my organization suggesting that all of this was possible, and facilitating the whole process.
And I have to ask you about the philanthropy gap, because I wasn't even aware of that. Tell us about that.
Well, I think people people who give money, who are in philanthropy, First of all, I don't think they understand the sort of size of the issue. And that's probably true for many people in society. It's not particularly true of them. But if most of us don't know these issues, why would they also? So that's one thing. And then I think the other thing is that they see it as a kind of never-ending problem, which actually it's not. Many, many, many people in our programs, and I'm sure Pamela can testify this to her own experience as well with programs in the United States, for example, many, many people get better and improve enormously with the current treatments that we have, and we shouldn't forget that. And so actually, although we started this particular meeting with, you know, some of the difficulties that we're facing, and they are real difficulties, there's also a message of hope, which is that actually, if we apply what we know and what we're learning now with a much more rigorous base that Pamela's emphasizing, we will be able to make great progress. And we need that funded both speculatively in the sense of, you know, trying out trials and pilot studies and so on and so forth, and also major programming. Because in my view, the weakness in this field is as much about major programming as it is about anything else. There is still a dearth of organizations that, for example, would like to work in the same space that we inhabit. There are only at the moment something between 5 and 6 international agencies who have major specialisms in mental health. There are lots of local agencies, of course, in country. That goes without saying. But it's still a very under-resourced field, both in terms of the manpower and in terms of the money.
Well, you mentioned collaborations. And Pamela, I want to ask you that the NIMH funds an initiative called the Collaborative Hubs for International Research on Mental Health. Can you tell us more about that and tell us what kind of context that can be used in?
Yeah, so this is an initiative that grew out of a meeting that we had, I guess, 5 years ago now in 2010, as we were beginning to develop our program on global mental health. And we thought, well, who are the key stakeholders that need to be in this room? And we had a small group of people, some policymakers from low and middle income countries, some implementation science researchers, international NGOs like Basic Needs, and advocacy groups, the voices of people using these services as well. And we had people sit around a table, and we said, well, how can research best serve your needs? And we got quite an array of answers. You know, one of the NGO representatives said, well, you know, I get to work, and there are 50 people already lined outside of our clinic at the beginning of the day, so I'm never going to read your article in JAMA or whatever. So I need guidelines. I need someone to tell me exactly what do I implement in my setting. People in the ministry representing ministries of health said, well, I need data to make the point to my finance minister that we need to invest in mental health care. So that's what I need. We need more epidemiology. We need more data. So we listened to all of these different viewpoints, and we thought about what we could do. And everyone agreed on some common issues, which you've heard about, the fact that there are not enough providers, the fact that there is an enormous treatment gap. And we developed this initiative called the Collaborative Hubs for International Research in Mental Health that was really based on, number one, just as we had done at this table, ensuring that the end users of the research would be part of the study from the beginning. So we asked our investigators to make sure that they were including representatives from local community-based organizations. We wanted to make sure that they were getting the patient viewpoint. We wanted to make sure they had local government involved as well, so that with the idea that when the study is over, what's going to be the best route, provided the study findings are positive and meaningful, what's going to be the best route to ensure public health uptake of these findings? And that happens best when people are engaged from the beginning and know about the study and can provide whatever inputs necessary. So that was one of the requirements. The second requirement was that they, you know, in whatever health system environment they were working in, that the research be focused on some aspect of task sharing, which we've been talking about, this idea of sharing tasks or shifting tasks from a more specialized provider to less specialized providers. And the other piece we were very interested in was research capacity building, that as they were conducting their research, they were also building infrastructure for research training and creating the capacity for people in these countries to conduct research. So one thing that we required was that these hubs be not just one university coming in, but that they had to have partnering countries, and that the benefits for research training would go not just to one country, but to all of the countries in a hub. And we ultimately funded 5 of these hubs. 2 of them are in sub-Saharan Africa, 2 are in Latin America, and 1 is in South Asia. And they're each groups of 4 to 6 countries working on various aspects of research on task shifting to deliver mental health services. And those range from using community health workers to address postpartum depression in South Africa or in Ethiopia, where the teams are trying to figure out how can we get care for schizophrenia in rural Ethiopia delivered by primary care clinics. In Nigeria and Ghana, they're looking at how do we actually link, as Chris pointed out, you know, this is really interesting, that there are more beds for care in traditional healing compounds or faith healing compounds in Ghana than there are in primary care. So you're going to find more beds for a person in need of psychiatric care in one of these facilities compared to a general hospital, for example. And so our teams are trying to understand, well, are there good ways to establish collaborations between these kinds of healing centers and primary care services? Can we get good care? Can we get good collaboration happening there? So, and in South Asia, maternal mental health is the focus as well, again, as I mentioned, with peers.
And what about domestically?
And domestically. So, you know, that's a very good question. Just recently, in IMH, and many of you may know, I don't know if you know, that the United States is currently chairing the Arctic Council, which is the group of 8 Arctic states in the world. And as a part of that activity, one of the issues that's come to prominence is mental health in the Arctic. There are incredibly high rates of suicide in the Arctic, which I'll actually talk a little bit about tomorrow. But at NIMH, we recently made public our interest in mental health in Alaska Native and American Indian communities, where we see very high rates of suicide. And the same model of the kind of collaborative hub may be very appropriate for these kinds of communities as well, because it will be equally important with whatever kind of interventions are studied to ensure that communities are on board, that local governments are on board, tribal authorities as well as state governments. All of these are key stakeholders that need to be fully engaged in the research so that the research actually is meaningful at the end.
One thing that you said that really stands out to me is end-user involvement across all stages of a program. And it shouldn't stand out to me, but it does because we don't hear about that so much. But Chris, I understand that Basic Needs does a similar thing in terms of engaging end-users.
Yeah, sure. That's really important, I think. At the moment, we have, in 2014, we had something like 42,000 people who were patients in the program. And about half of them belong to self-help groups of one kind or another. At the moment, we have about 500 self-help groups globally. And so the self-help group has become both really important to the users themselves. That's because it's the focus of having social activity. It's often the focus for work-related decisions and so on. It's the place where a lender of small, a micro lender can actually come and discuss with a group of people how a micro lending program might work, and that's a very important feature for people trying to get back into the economy at some level or another. And so yes, we really take that very seriously indeed, and quite a lot of the training that we do is of our partners who then would support that particular kind of activity.
And tell us about you bringing your model potentially to the US.
Well, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation have invited us to do an experiment to see whether our model would work in the US. We're very early days still. In fact, the advisory committee that we've just started to put together is meeting for the first time in Washington at the end of July. Then it proceeds into 2 trial periods, and we'll have to see whether there is adaptation required to the model. Quite probably there would be. And we'll have to see how it works. But it's an interesting idea to turn the world upside down, as it were, and to have a model which might work in other areas. And of course, if you think about it, there are many countries in the world which are in the global north, where there are huge disparities, as we have been hearing earlier, in terms of the numbers of physicians available, psychiatrists, resources, and so on and so forth. And so it would be interesting to see whether this particular model works, particularly in those kinds of areas.
Did you hear at the opening session yesterday, BJ Miller said something really interesting. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, that it's not that we need new things, it's that we need to implement the things that we know work. And you both remind me of that, but do you want to comment on that statement? Do you feel like there's too much research potentially in mental health and not enough doing? You're such a doer.
Well, I definitely want people to do. There's no question about that. Obviously not in a kind of chaotic and mindless sense, but I think it's really important to have more substantial programs out there, both in the area that I know best in the developing world and in other places as well, because it is absolutely essential that we get on top of this issue. I was very disappointed to see recently that the Secretary General of the UN is about to declare the new Sustainable Development Goals, which follow on from the Millennium Development Goals. And guess what? You know, mental illness is hardly there. It's been discussed quite a lot, it's been talked about, but it's been compressed and compressed into more generalized goals. So in fact, the poor old mentally ill, you know, who number large numbers in our world, are not going to be recognized by this very important global representation. So, which is in stark contrast to the World Health Organization, which has decided that it has to have its own program of activity, MH gap, mental health gap, where it's trying to challenge this treatment gap that we were talking about earlier.
Pamela, did I offend you by saying there might be too much research and not enough doing?
No, I actually think it's an unfair dichotomy, right? In fact, in global health in particular, we need the research to identify the interventions that work, and then you implement those, but you have to keep learning even as you're implementing, right? So I think there's a role for research and practice as an integrated way of operating to actually make sure that we keep improving the quality of what we do. So I hate to hear that dichotomy. Mm-hmm. I think that they're both important and should be informing each other. Yeah. So practice should be informing research, and research should be informing practice.
Yeah. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about stigma. It's a huge, broad issue, and Pamela used to be a stigma researcher. But I was reminded of this yesterday. I went paragliding at 6 a.m., and my paragliding instructor insisted that I mention today that Pitkin County, where we are sitting, has one of the highest suicide rates in the country. And I fact-checked it, and it was true. And in fact, on the bus back from paragliding, there were so many advertisements on that one bus I was on about Aspen Hope, Aspen Strong, and different mental health organizations talking about stigma being a really big challenge. Since it is a broad area, let's talk a bit about discrimination as one manifestation of stigma against people living with a mental illness. There's stigma in the labor market, the housing market, so many things. So I want to ask you a big question. As a stigma researcher or a former stigma researcher, can we ever get rid of that discrimination? And if you think we can, what would it take?
That's a great question. And, you know, You're probably all familiar with many anti-stigma campaigns to educate people about mental illnesses. And what we know is that what seems to work is a mix of education and contact. So actually having personal contact with people who are suffering from these disorders. So you demystify as you educate and destigmatize. And the contact seems to work best when it happens in the context. First best if it's people that you know, that you have a relationship with. So whether it's friends, neighbors, family members, but being able to have open conversation about experiences and being able to do that when people are on an equal platform, that there's not a power differential, that seems to facilitate the best results from structured contact. So I think those are promising interventions. The UK has a very large stigma campaign going on right now that integrates both of those, both educating the public, but actually creating days and creating events where people can have contact and can come together and actually get to know each other.
Has that ever happened in the US, that kind of campaign?
We've certainly had public, you know, service campaigns and public education campaigns, but I don't think with this sort of this combination of ensuring that people actually meet each other, that people interact in a meaningful way, I'm not aware of that in the U.S. At least not on a large, on a grand scale.
Chris, what's the basic needs approach to reducing discrimination?
Well, first of all, of course, it's true that when you go into communities, the family members of a person with a serious mental illness struggle between, on the one hand, really wanting their family member to come to the group meeting, to be part of the first initial sort of beginnings of a program, and on the other hand, and this is their words, not mine, on the other hand, they say, the thing is that we feel really shamed. So they are, in a sense, and again, I use this word very advisedly, they are crippled by their shame. And so they feel this intense pressure, which you know, is difficult, I think. I never really understood its palpability until I actually went amongst people such as we're talking about now and actually saw people weeping with the stress of the shame, not the illness. So from that point of view, we have to understand that this is a very palpable. And for most people who actually are in this position, and let's remember those large numbers again, those people who are in that position, that shame is palpable and it's lived. Do you know what I mean? It's actually lived. So to move through a state of community action is not simply because it's like the only option there is. Mm. It's not simply because it's better than technology or anything like that. It's also because it's in the hands of the community where the rooting of this shame lies. So the deracination of this, the unrooting of this, has to lie, as it were, within your program mechanism. It has to lie, actually, in getting people to work together to understand this and to so, in the end, be able to work it through. I think, Seema, there's one thing I wanted to say which sounds a bit Victorian, but what I have found within the cycle of our model is that when people start to go back to work, you suddenly notice a gear change in this question of stigma. People say things like, well, at least he's trying. Mm. Or they say things like, did you know he's actually gone farming with his father again? She's helping wash up the dishes. We've never seen that before. And so, try as we might to understand these things through public education, actually, in the end, quite often, it is their own actions which make it more understandable.
Do you agree with that, Pamela?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think you've said that quite well.
So I have a final question for you before I open up the floor for a Q&A, and it's very much a question from my role as a journalist. And I think we're talking about stigma and discrimination and misunderstanding. I think a lot of that misinformation is perpetuated by the media. And I should say there are good examples of discussions about mental health as well. The Aspen Times, for example, you can Google, they did a really good 4-part series on mental health and suicide in, you know, the very region that we are enjoying right now. And it just so happens on Monday, I'm teaching at a reporting institute for journalists who cover mental health and suicide. And these are people who are very committed to doing a good job at reporting ethically and accurately and not adding to the stigma. But how would you like to see journalists report better on mental illness? Pamela, would you like to comment?
I actually think it would be important to make sure that you've got the viewpoint of people with mental illness in your stories. So it's not just that you're reporting about this, but get the reflections, get the insights from people that have the lived experience of managing these disorders.
Yeah. Chris?
Well, First Lady Carter and her husband have done a huge amount to work with reporters in the context of mental illness, and I think the Carter Center is certainly just something to hold up and to admire in that context. I fully agree with what Pamela has said. And I think it's really important, and I think this is possible for journalists to do very well, it's important to bring the life stories of people to our attention, mixing it, as it were, with the appropriate information and knowledge. Because it's only when we see, oh my goodness, this could be my family. And, you know, 1 in 4 of the global population, roughly speaking, 1 in 4 will have a mental illness or will know people with mental illness and so on. It's those huge dimensions. Oh my God, it's that. So we don't want to frighten people, but we want to bring it to their attention so that they will pay more attention to their own families, to their own communities. And I think journalists could do a great job there. The thing that journalists do sometimes, and you can understand it, but it's not helpful. The thing that journalists do sometimes is they have this, you know, the monster, the person who runs berserk through the streets and so on and so forth. That's unhelpful. It's also extremely, extremely rare in the context of the full panoply of mental illness. And so to be able to diffuse that and yet still bring an interesting story through life stories, I think, is probably the way through.
Thank you so much for sharing your insights. Now we'll open up for questions and answers. And please just wait for a microphone to reach you. We have one question over here and then one over there. Thanks.
Thank you for the presentation. It was great. As a PhD practicing clinical psychologist and owner of a company that provides large-scale psychological services to hospitals and companies across the country, it's clear that we're pretty good at providing these services to the fairly educated and employed. What we've been trying to get our arms around is the population, 600,000 or 700,000, who are homeless or indigent. How can we create a model that disrupts that paradigm? 50-60% of that population does have some form of mental illness. We've been thinking maybe we can pay them for engagement and compliance, essentially sending sociological SWAT teams into certain areas. I'm in Columbus, Ohio, and taking 8 or 10 and basically saying, we're going to pay you $10 an hour to come to our counseling group. We're going to pay you to be on your Prolixin, what have you. Is anybody doing that?
That's a great question. You know, there are certainly kind of cash incentives for other areas of public health. I've not heard about that in the context of mental health care, but I think you make a great point in that, you know, when you look at, in the U.S., when you actually look at people's preferences for kinds of treatments, one of the things that we find in many ethnic minority groups is that people actually would like to have psychotherapy interventions, and often when you're living in a poor neighborhood, you don't have access to psychotherapists. And even clinics, public clinics in those contexts, are pressured to not necessarily have providers that are delivering those kinds of services. So, number one, getting the services into the community in general so that people can get access to them, I think is incredibly important. And whether or not cash incentives work, I think that's an empirical question.
Chris, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, in another life, I'm a mentor, and I have a small mentoring practice. And one of my mentees is Charlie Howard, who's in the UK context, well-known for working with gangs as a psychologist. And she first went across to New York, took some training there from your gangs, and then went back to London and works with gangs there. And her reporting is this. This is how she sees it. She says, first of all, time is irrelevant. So if you say, I'm going to give you an appointment at 10 o'clock, forget it. You know. So she's really interested in the contact. 1 minute's worth of contact is an achievement for a psychologist in that context. Practicing on the doorstep of the tenement the housing association tenement would be a very important place to work. So she basically gets psychologists out of the clinic, out of the office, out of the bureau. It's not about time, it's about contact. And so, of course, the investment then, you know, has to be paid for by some other means. These people are not, however wealthy they may be, and they may have plenty of bling, but they're not going to pay you. And so you have to be able to, the rewards are huge, however. The rewards are huge. And the cuspal moment is always when the gang member is deciding to reorganize their life in some way. And departing from the gang is the thing that they fear the most, and they feel the most pain about. They feel that it's a real sadness that they're going to leave this family. And so it's a bereavement process, exactly that. And so that's all of what she's started to tackle with, and she's written well on it and so on, and I'd be happy to.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
We have a question way over here, the lady in white.
Thank you. There's different schools of thought on the nomenclature of mental health and what that comprises, and often whether or not that includes addictions. And my question for you is, from my personal experience, it's very difficult to separate the two in terms of implementing models of care, but my question for you both is whether, in the context of what you've discussed today, whether addictions was sort of a part of what you've been talking about or how it interacts with some of the things that you've tried to do.
By the way, I'm not a doctor, so I'm a farmer by training, which is useful when you're working with people who have to earn a living. So I'm going to leave the doctoring part to Pamela, but it seems to me that it's that a lot of the people we work with do come to the program with a habit, one habit or another. And so the smoking of ganja, you know, very large amounts of weed, seems to trigger illness in quite a lot of cases. And so there are certainly many issues. The professionals that we work with in the countries that I've mentioned already always find it hard to know, as it were, what to tackle first and how to work with that. And that, I think, is a problem which is shared by professionals worldwide, actually. And again, we have to fall back in our own context on societal support. Of course, if the person has been difficult in the social sense, if they've created a lot of mayhem in their own family, it makes it much more difficult. But we see plenty of it, yeah. And we treat it, and we treat with it in the sense that it's part of the whole person.
Do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I certainly, in the numbers that Chris was talking about, in the way that we add up the burden of these disorders, people are talking about mental disorders, substance use disorders, all of these as one category. But there's such a dearth of providers or interventions, especially in the poorest countries around substance use disorders. So huge, tremendously huge need. And also just incredibly, you know, very rapid growth in the problem as well. So we've seen incredible increases in opiate addiction, other uses of drugs, so very big problem.
I have one question over there.
So I have two quick questions. For you, Pamela, you started by talking about the access to care of mental health services, and I want to ask you kind of from the other side about the impact of care. So we learned from HIV the cascade of care that even for the patients, people who get access to antiretroviral therapy, only 26% of them actually achieve their therapeutic goals. So I'd like to ask how you see the cascade of care for mental health. And then, Chris, I think we're all shocked to hear about statistics about the shortage of practitioners, mental health practitioners, you mentioned, but generally the shortage of practitioners in the developing setting. And this morning in the Ebola session, we heard from the expert from Sierra Leone talk about how Ebola has decimated what was already, you know, a less than robust workforce. And I remember reading at the time that one of the West African countries, because of Ebola, was left with 11 pediatricians for the whole country. So in that context, when you're trying to engage Gates or international NGOs like PATH Program, they've been very active in HIV and Ebola, and we understand why that is, and less perhaps so in mental health. So what kind of evidence base should we be building beyond the size of the problem that might help to engage their commitment?
Pamela, let's hear from you about the cascade of care.
Yeah, it's in some ways, I feel like it's much easier to track that in HIV because you go in for a test. You have to come back and get your test result. Then you have to go and get your, you know, someone has to decide whether you are adherence ready to begin a treatment, and then they can follow up with your treatment every month. So we don't really have that same model, obviously, in mental health care. But I guess the question is, you know, do people stay in care? And when they stay in care, do they have decent outcomes? And I think that varies widely. Certainly, as Chris was saying earlier, we have treatments that provide tremendous relief to people. I don't know of a study off the top of my head that would actually trace that cascade in a similar way. But I do think that if you can get people engaged in care, that's a huge step. And figuring out what are the ways that keep people in care is a huge step as well. I think the other side of that, though, is the question of demand, actually, because that actually is an issue, right? That's an issue in places where there is not a lot of mental health literacy, where people may be experiencing symptoms, but they don't know what they are. I was talking to a colleague in Rwanda who was not a mental health specialist, but was learning to screen people with HIV, in fact, for depression, and said that, you know, he says, you know, once you realize, you know, you realize that these symptoms that someone's coming in with, that they're not looking well, that this is actually depression. He says, it's marvelous, because you realize that it's something you can do something about. And then so people aren't necessarily recognizing the symptoms in themselves. You've got someone that's screening them and then saying, oh, you know, this actually is a syndrome. This is actually something we can intervene on. And you get that person into care. In the same context, a nurse talked about a man that she was treating, also for HIV, who had depression. And he got treated for his depression, and he was just so, he was so amazed that and in this case, they were actually providing antidepressants for care. And he felt that his antidepressant, he began to see it in the same way as his antiretroviral therapy, that this is my lifesaver. This is what's actually saved my life and is actually transforming the way I feel. But that requires education. People have to know that what I'm experiencing is actually something that can be intervened on.
So thanks for your question, and just to literally follow from Pamela in a way to begin to answer it. We often experience people who think so highly of the treatment that they're receiving that they will travel 2 or 3 days by foot to the clinic every month to take the monthly ration of pills that they're allowed and travel back. In one case, in many cases, they travel across borders. So people have traveled from Mozambique to Tanzania, where our program was in the south there. And in the case of Ghana, they traveled across a large river, Burkina Faso, to Ghana. They wrapped a little in plastic, the medicines, put it on their head, and swam back across the river. So people really, really seek the treatment, and they really value it. But to come more precisely to your question, I think one of the things that's true about mental illness is that it pops up it's a horizontal thing. It's not really a vertical thing. It pops up in the lives of mothers with postpartum depression. It pops up with men who drink too much. You know, it pops up. It comes in all kinds of ways. And in a way, we have to be able to say to the philanthropist or whoever it might be, the funder, look, this is the one of the determinants, in a sense, the co-determinant of all of these different issues. And if we can tackle this piece of that person's life, the rest can also be tackled more effectively. And so the question of people who are comorbid is very important here. And I think that's an issue. They may be comorbid, like have a depression, but also have tuberculosis, of course. But it's often more subtle than that. And I think that's a very important issue from our point of view. When it comes to Sierra Leone, there's absolutely no doubt about it that when a country is savaged, as it were, in that particular way, as you've described, there is also a long tail. So in an emergency, there's a long tail. So people go in, they work on the emergency, they do a lot of stuff, and they go. And the people who are left are those who have been blighted, of course, physically, but they're also blighted in the sense that they have mental health problems. They may have short-term problems of stress and so on, which can be relieved if they are relieved. But many of these will then morph into longer-term illnesses.
Thank you so much. We have time for one more question. Lady over there.
I'll be fast. Teletherapy, hope or hype?
I think it's a great hope. You know, there are so many places. Certainly, you know, in the United States, we have rural areas in the United States. You just don't have providers, and there are policy challenges in terms of how physicians can practice across state borders and what are the licensing related issues. But I think we're seeing great results from that. And also, I've actually, you know, from, this is anecdotal, I'm not citing research necessarily here, but just from providers who are sometimes serving small communities, people sometimes prefer that link with someone outside because of the confidentiality issues, and they're not actually having to be forced to meet with someone in their very, very small community. So certainly the studies that are published around telepsychiatry show that it's feasible, it's acceptable, and you can get the same kinds of therapeutic outcomes.
What do you think, Chris?
No, I think it should be part of the mix. You know, I think it's important. One of my fellow scholar awardees has done quite a lot of work in terms of doing teletherapy and also making it a small income generator for the person who's operating at the extreme end, at the remote end, and being able to, so people pay a small fee, a tiny fee, and then they sit in front of the webcam and the whole thing starts. So I think it's part of the mix.
Thank you so much. Please join me in thanking our esteemed panel.